W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. The House will vote tomorrow on a two-year reauthorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. FBI Director Christopher Wray told a House subcommittee hearing, the sooner they do, the better.
We've seen the threat from foreign terrorists rise to a whole nother level after October 7th.
Says bad actors inspired by the events in the Mideast and Russia could launch an attack on U.S. soil at any time. Shohei Ohtani's former interpreter will surrender to federal authorities tomorrow. Ipe Mizuhara is accused of stealing millions of dollars from the L.A. Dodgers star to settle gambling debts.
The evidence we've gathered over the past few weeks has demonstrated that in total, Mr. Mizuhara stole over $16 million from Mr. Ohtani's account in order to pay for these illegal sports bets.
U.S. Attorney Martin Estrada. Stocks closed mixed today. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Wisconsin teachers are leaving the profession at an alarming rate. That's according to the Department of Public Instruction's workforce report for 2022. The report also says teacher pay in real dollars has dropped 20% over the past 12 years. Changes for the better at Wisconsin's youth prisons. Limits on pepper spray, restraints, and strip searches correlate with better behavior. Deputy Corrections Secretary Jared Hoy tells a state Senate committee that's not all.
Staff morale was exceptionally good overall at the time of the visit. A review of video over the reporting period showed staff regularly engaging with youth. Staff were extremely friendly.
New rules on a trial basis at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake schools since February could become permanent this year. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Sometimes our healthcare system can feel impersonal. Who can help my healthcare team understand what is important to me? Who can connect me with community services and health resources?
Community health representatives can. Community health representatives, or CHRs, live and work in our community, so they understand your unique health needs and can break down the barriers that get between you and the quality care you deserve. Want to learn more? See all the good community health representatives do at dhs.wisconsin.gov/CHR.
Your forecast for you and your community.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Looks like possibly, maybe, could be a settlement in East Palestine as Norfolk Southern has agreed to a $600 million settlement. I gotta tell you, sounds like a lot of money. Big money. $600 million sounds like a big chunk of change. But once you divvy it up, I don't know. Now, if you remember, you know, February last year, you had a train derailment. Several cars spilled what some describe as a cocktail of hazardous materials that caught on fire. Days later, they blew up, five tankers of vinyl chloride and then burned all the toxic chemicals away. And we all remember the images of the plumes of smoke and the a scene that you never thought you would see in this country on purpose. And look, there's a lot of questions on why they did this, given the fact that we're now finding out more and more about, the rationale doesn't seem to be holding water. The report from the NTSB will be available, I guess, in June. So we'll see from there. But you had, anywhere between 1,500 and 2,000 residents who were evacuated, and more people, were affected by this. So for me, let's say it's 2,000 people. That simple math is about $300,000 a person. I don't know that's enough. given the fact that people's homes and their property are you moving to East Palestine? And then the health effects and all the stuff that comes with it, considering that residents are still suffering from respiratory ailments. On Facebook, I was looking at one of the sites where, you know, people are still talking about these weird rashes they're getting, kids having nosebleeds, all of this, well, unexplained. Don't know where it came from. It just, man, bad luck, I guess. No, and this isn't funny, but, you know, that could be the argument. Well, you know, we're not finding anything. Now, what I found interesting as I was reading through some of the stories on this is Norfolk Southern said the agreement, what they agreed to, if it is approved by the court, would resolve all class action cases within a 20-mile radius of the derailment. And it would also solve all of their problems for residents who, well, choose to participate in this personal injury part of this within 10 miles. I don't know if everyone else is, well, you're just on your own or what. But this seems, I don't know, seems like a big idea, a big thing, considering that you're talking about, you know, a good-sized little town and all the little larger towns and all the little areas around it. $600 million, it sounds like a lot. The part that stuck with me is you go, well, the money doesn't sound like enough, especially when you're talking about this is a company that just in the first 3 months of this year had $3 billion in revenue. And even if they pay this $600 million, would still have over $213 million in profit for the quarter. So this is a little bump in the road to the profitability game. But the part that grabbed my attention is, well, the settlement doesn't hold them liable. There's no admission of liability, no admission of wrongdoing, no, oh, our bad, not even, hey, we're sorry. And are you surprised? I guess that becomes the next question. Are you surprised that corporate America not really held accountable? The $600 million, trust me, we're going to pay back in multiples over the next several years, as they'll just jack up the price a little bit to cover their costs. There's no pain. There's no punishment. There's no one going to jail. There's no one being, you know, brought into the public square. And you can make the argument the CEO maybe a little bit, but because evidently there's an activist investor who's trying to oust the CEO of Norfolk Southern, this Shaw guy, who you go, shouldn't this be part of the I don't know. But I do find it interesting that the article did talk about the fact that Joe Biden never declared the town a disaster. And look, he's taking some arrows over this. People are still a little sore. And as I understand it, I think this kind of declaration's only been used once by the EPA. And that was in a much worse context. But it's one of these things, as I understand it, if he does make this designation, then the taxpayers are on the hook for all future costs, which, understand, taxpayers are going to be on the hook for these costs anyway, because we never really hold these companies accountable. There's never a moment where you go, yeah, everyone was made whole. There was never a moment where you go, yeah, the company's really, they took a hit here, but they did the right thing. I don't ever remember that story. And I don't think this is going to be it either. Now, the railroad says that they're going to create a fund to pay for future healthcare costs, the long-term needs of people in this community, although haven't figured that out yet. There's part of me that goes, once they get these class action suits behind them, once they've got that kind of immunity thing, if you will, I think there's always going to be a reason why. And worse yet, look, let's say they do set up a big fund with a lot of money. You think about the tobacco fund years ago. You think about the opioid crisis and the lawsuits that came out of that. And you look at the states that saw that as a slush fund. Does this become another one of those scenarios? How long before legislators go, hey, we can rob Peter and, well, pay our friends? In Ohio? Ohio seems to be, I don't know if you've noticed, the corruption. The corruption seems to be rampant. In fact, a second person having to deal with this energy thing that they had, this house, I think it was House Bill 6 or something. A second person has killed themselves over all of this. The first guy, he committed suicide while wearing a DeWine t-shirt. This latest guy hung himself, and no DeWine t-shirt, but with direct ties. Kind of got to wonder about the corruption going on there. So if you're in East Palestine, are you thrilled with the idea that your corrupt legislature, the Republicans controlling that state are going to have your interests in mind? Not so much. Now, this brings me to the fact that the good folks over at Good Jobs First, they put out a report here just the other day talking about the $1 trillion corporate misconduct mark. Evidently, you got corporations who have been acting badly. And part of doing business in this country is, you pay out some hush money, you pay out some, we're going to have non-disclosure agreements and deferred prosecution agreements and all this stuff that, allows corporations to get away with, in a lot of cases, serious injury and even death. As they point out, between regulatory fines, criminal penalties, and class action settlements, corporate America here in the U.S. since 2000 has paid $1 trillion. $1 trillion. Now, they said, look, from the early 2000s, it was about $7 billion a year. It has gone to well more than $50 billion in recent years. And they point out a sevenfold increase or a 300% increase in constant dollars. They have this great thing on their website, and I highly suggest people take a look at the violation tracker over at Good Jobs First, where they point out, there's a database of 127 large parent companies and how much they've paid, all of them more than $1 billion in fines and settlements over the past quarter. And look, you look at who they are. There are big financial industries. There are big pharmaceutical companies. There are the oil and gas folks. There are utilities, looking at you, Ohio. Think about it. Bank of America, by far the worst of the offenders, according to this report. $87 billion. BP, because of the Deepwater Horizon. They're up there. Volkswagen, because of the emissions cheating that they were doing. Johnson & Johnson, because of, talcum powder cancer. PP&G, wildfires out west. There's been a bunch of this stuff. And, we don't get to see most of it because, it's shrouded in, we can't see what's in it. Non-disclosure agreements, non-prosecution agreements. But we have the ability to hold these people accountable. And I look at East Palestine. This should be one of the places where you go, let's hold them accountable. Let's do that now. Interesting. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. David Madeline from the Center for American Progress is going to be here back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week, some really good job numbers. What was it? 303,000 jobs created in the month of March. a lot of construction, a lot of healthcare, some government jobs. I'd like to have seen more manufacturing jobs, but 6,500 auto worker jobs, that's good stuff. All the messaging I see, economy going in the right direction. We're moving slowly but surely forward. Wages are ticking up. Inflation, well, still struggling with that. And I fear that if the Fed lowers rates, what I'm hearing, housing could go up. We'll see. But the message coming out of this is we're going in a good direction. The economy's not bad. I understand working people are not maybe seeing enough of it. But we can organize our way towards that. But here to share some thoughts on what is the economy doing? What is the actual messaging? I've asked David Madlin to come talk with us. He's a senior fellow over at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. He's also the author of Reunion, how bold labor reforms can repair, revitalize, and reunite the United States. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks. A pleasure. Always glad to be with you.
So this frame, the economy's terrible. Everything's falling. There's a recession. I haven't heard it in a couple of days. Recession's around the corner. This doomsday naysayer kind of stuff that seems to be prevalent everywhere. How is the economy doing in your estimation?
Well, yeah, by most measures, the U.S. economy is doing really well. You know, job growth has been really strong. Hundreds of thousands of new jobs every month consistently for many, many months. Unemployment near record lows, our GDP growth really quite high. Inflation still a little bit elevated, but declining well below it was just a year or so ago. And these are just sort of compared to the US, but also when you compare us internationally, very strong, much faster recovery from the COVID recession than pretty much any other country. And then, you know, as sort of the big question though, is why are, you know, Americans relatively pessimistic about the economy now when most all of the indicators are very positive? And this is the big question. I don't think anyone's gonna have the full answer. I've got some thoughts that I wanna get into with you about it, but most signs are really pretty good. The one, and this is, I think, a big one, is wages are just now starting to grow, adjusted for inflation, and it's been a little while since they've really grown.
Yeah, but, you know, as I've been saying, David, you know, that's been a problem for the last 40 years. You know, and I don't know if we're just now discovering that, you know, wages have been stagnant for a very long time, and families have been struggling. I don't know if this is a remnant of all of that, or if it's just that we're constantly inundated with right-wing messaging that, you know, Biden's screwing everything up. And if, you know, if Biden's done it, it's got to be bad. If the Democrats have done anything, it's got to be horrible. And of course, the sky's falling and, you know, you're going to lose everything because of this. We've been sold this kind of constant barrage of messaging when, in fact, the reality is jobs every month keep going up. Unemployment under 4% for in one more month will have tied the record of all time from when they keep record, been keeping records. I mean, for all intent and purposes, we should be dancing in the streets.
Yeah, well, not almost. I think if things continue, we should be dancing in the streets. We're not quite there yet, which gets to, you know, the reasons why. You mentioned, I think, two of the really big ones. This sort of partisan polarization that no matter, you know, if the economy is doing really good and the Republicans in office, Democrats aren't going to give credit. And if the economy is doing really well and Joe Biden's in office, Republicans are less likely to give credit. That's very true. The other, as you mentioned, is wages have been stagnant for most of the past, you know, 4 or 5 decades, only a few periods where they've had any real growth. And so there's this long bubbling frustration that I think really came to a head during the COVID recession because workers were deemed essential, but their wages were still, you know, stagnant. They were called into unsafe conditions and their CEOs were getting record salaries and corporate profits at record highs. So I think there's that simmering, long-standing frustration. But I also think, you know, there's this element of reality too, that inflation really undercut wage gains for a couple of years for a lot of workers. And we're just now back on track. The inflation was caused by the supply chain bottlenecks from COVID that, you know, again, US inflation is below the rest of the world now. We're much, much better off, but it's still left people's, you know, feeling more squeezed. And the real wage gains that's above inflation are just for the past, you know, several months really kicking in. So if this continues, I think people will actually feel a pretty good economy and say, you know what, things are going in the right direction. We can see this with the polls that though Americans are pretty pessimistic about the economy right now, it's moving upwards as real wages are increasing.
Yeah, and I've been arguing that, you know, the more we see that out of policy that is being actually done, like for instance, I was just driving you know, up 11 and 15 in our neighborhood, and there's a sign on the side of the road that, hey, this project brought to you by the Investment Act, you know, by Biden policy, that this is because of the infrastructure bill. This is happening only because of that. We needed it. But, you know, this is where that money's going. So I think as people become more aware of the investments that are being made and the policy choices that were made, I'm thinking, or at least hoping, that they'll go, hey, this is not bad. Maybe we should do more of it.
Yeah, I think that's the plan is, you know, to understand why is the American economy doing really pretty well, especially compared to most others. And I think a big part of that are these major investments that President Biden has passed. Infrastructure, the big one. We're finally going to start repairing bridges and roads and the like, massive investments. And those are just now starting to get underway. You know, it takes a little while. When they talk about some project, they talk about shovel ready. Well, the big ones, the ones that really need to get done, there's real planning behind it, and it takes a little while to do that. Similarly to a lot of the projects that are being funded under what, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act or the CHIPS and Science Act, which are to spur investments in electric vehicle production and computer chips, for example. These are private companies that they're going to get incentives from the government to do this. And they need to create their own structure and plan. It's like, hey, we're going to build a new factory. Well, it's not just shovel ready. It does take a little time. And we're seeing now those projects starting to get underway. And I think that gets to your point of there'll be the macro evidence that the economy, if wages continue to rise, that people will feel good, but also that they'll be around the corner. They'll look and they'll say, hey, this factory's under construction. This road is being repaired, and I understand why it's happening. I think that is the best and the most likely scenario for what could happen, because generally, and the research is really pretty clear, that when the economy is doing well, people are more likely to reward the politicians who were supportive of those policies that helped the economy do well.
Yeah, but here's the weird thing. You know, I keep seeing stories of all these people who voted against the infrastructure bill taking credit for the things that came out of the infrastructure bill, which I find really funny.
Well, who wouldn't want to take credit? People like this is, you know, infrastructure is about, you know, we are a polarized society, and yet infrastructure, bipartisan support. Everyone likes it on the ground. You know, the voters who are Republican or Democrats do want roads that function. They want to be able to get around. They want goods to be able to get to market faster. So people like these projects. Unfortunately, the Congress is so dysfunctional and polarized that a lot of politicians, typically most of them Republicans, but there was a bipartisan infrastructure bill. It was Republicans and Democrats that supported it and passed it. And President Joe Biden signed it. He got it done. Donald Trump claimed to be infrastructure weak, never got it done. But so Biden gets a lot of credit, but it still was a bipartisan thing. Unfortunately, then you have the politicians who voted against it still championing it. But you can get away, sadly, I think we find out you can get away with a lot because it's hard for voters to really follow and know that, hey, my elected official didn't actually support the underlying bill. They're just now championing the projects that are happening. And that's where all of the, you know, we've had this conversation. This is where things like unions really come into play, because they help educate voters about what's really going on. It's not, you know, most of us don't spend our lives following the political details, and we need a little help to sort of navigate who's telling the truth here. And groups like unions can really help us do that.
No, and it was, this is what we've been saying for a very long time. And these projects that are being built, they're hopefully being done with project labor agreements. They're done with union wage labor so that the benefits of those projects actually do trickle down the local communities. In fact, one of the things we're putting together right now is, you know, back in 2022, we did a version of our Working Class Heroes radio tour, and we went to places that used to have, you know, manufacturing, factories in there that were part of that community, that community was known for, that created the employment, that then supported the rest of the community. You went to these places and they're struggling. That major employment driver isn't there. And now you have all of these societal ills. In this iteration of our tour, we want to go to the places that are going to be the next generation of communities that are going to have these factories or these industries that are going to be the driver of prosperity for working people because of the policies of this administration. Because I think we need to be talking about that. We need to have sound policy, smart investment, if we're going to rebuild a prosperous working class in this country. Or any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's great that you're planning to go and actually talk to the people in the communities that are being impacted by these big projects. And I think, you know, I've done a little bit of research around this kind of topic too. And I think among the things that are really interesting, one thing we found was that communities that lost manufacturing jobs over the past two decades. So these are the places that have really been decimated by terrible policy that, you know, from NAFTA to China into the WTO, decimated by those kind of bad policies, are more likely to get new investments from these Biden policies than other communities, because that's where a lot of the manufacturing is being reinvested into these kind of areas. So you might be going back to some of the places you were before. The other thing that's, you know, we've been finding is that the construction jobs building these plants, as you mentioned, a lot of them have project labor agreements or prevailing wage, and they often are really good union jobs that, you know, I interviewed workers talking about transformative, life-changing, best thing. They went from poverty to being in the middle class to being able to buy a house. Really, really important. Big question is whether, you know, the voters are going to recognize this, but also the manufacturing jobs, there's not as strong of the sort of what I call strings on them. And so it's going to be an additional effort, including by unions. And we can see this big, you know, reunion push around, like UAW trying to unionize a lot of the factories. But so there's still a lot more to be done to ensure the manufacturing jobs are going to be good union jobs. And construction is also still more there too, but a lot, really pretty good start so far.
And about time they start organizing and really putting a bet in the farm on it. I mean, at this point, the argument of we're going to keep the powder dry, that's not a good argument, because, you know, when it's over, maybe the best thing will happen, you'll have dry powder. But, you know, this is the thing. As an economist, you understand that when you have those decent wages going into building projects, when you have those good wages going into manufacturing, that there is that reverberation effect into the local economy. I mean, there's study after study that shows this. When you invest smartly, there's a benefit to people who don't even get those jobs. There's a benefit to the small business owner, to the local property tax base. There are many benefits that we're not really talking about.
Yeah, so there's certainly the direct benefits from creating these good jobs, that those workers' lives improve. But then they're able to spend money, additional money, and that creates these, you know, additional kinds of jobs you're talking about. And that is key, not just for like, okay, you build a new factory and then a sandwich shop across the street opens, but it's even much bigger than that, because then new businesses, this is sort of basic kind of Keynesian economics, new businesses start because there's going to be increasing consumer demand. And that it's this increasing consumer demand is sort of this virtuous cycle, that when workers have high or wages are growing, they spend more, that causes businesses to say, you know what, this is a place we want to be. And they grow there, invest there, and this creates then more high-paying jobs. And that's the kind of cycle we are trying to create. And it's sort of the direct opposite of the old failed trickle-down theory, which says you cut taxes on business, you cut taxes on the rich, and they're going to invest. But we know actually what causes businesses to invest is growing consumer demand. And so, and you build growing consumer demand by creating good, solid union jobs.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like common sense. It really does. It seems, but we've been sold the other thing for so long. I think we've internalized that if only we cut more taxes for the rich, if we just gave them more, that maybe something would fall out of their pockets. Hasn't happened yet, but who knows? Maybe someday. But David, I appreciate the time as always. Good stuff. I'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Rick, thanks very much for having me.
David Madeline, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Want to hear your thoughts. Is there a project in your neck of the woods that maybe we should be stopping by and talking to people at? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com, because we want to come and visit you, especially if we visited you last time. I want to hear it. Back after this.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Showers continuing to look likely here in the overnight. Clouds and breezy northwest winds. Looking at mid-40s by sunrise. Any early morning showers ending Friday. Skies turning mostly sunny. Breezy with highs in the low to mid-50s. Right now, it's 48.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So back in 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act established, among other things, a minimum wage law. You know, we got rid of child labor, too, which my Republican friends seem to be wanting to get rid of today. We're going to make child labor great again. But, you know, in 1938, they said, hey, let's establish a minimum wage, which at the time was whopping 25 cents an hour. And look, the economy was so much different back then, much different than it is today. And so they made lots of exemptions. There were compromises, if you will. And those compromises, unfortunately, in today's world, seem to hit women, farmers, truck drivers, other low-wage workers the hardest. Basically, the voiceless of that era were left behind. And surprise, surprise, still kind of today. So the federal minimum wage today, $7.25 an hour, which has not been raised in, what, 15 years? 2009 was the last time they raised it, which is bad, terrible, unforgivable. But, you know, you look at the tipped minimum wage, $2.13 an hour. That hasn't been raised since the 90s. So imagine my surprise when I see a story coming out of Georgia. Yeah, Georgia. A bipartisan effort coming out of Georgia to end something called the sub-minimum wage. As if $7.25 isn't bad enough, legally it can get lower. And here to talk about what's happening in Georgia, I've asked Julia Metro to come talk with us. She's a fellow at Mother Jones, where she covers disability and public health. She's got an article over there, motherjones.com, if you want to take a look at it, titled, In Georgia, a Rare Bipartisan Push for Disability Rights. Julia, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. Well, unfortunately, in many states, it is legal to pay disabled people just 25 cents an hour or even less.
So no, it's crazy. No, it's absolutely crazy. But there is a push in Georgia and in other states to end this, isn't there?
Yeah. So Georgia is the 17th state that could pass legislation to end this practice. 16 states so far have either passed legislation to end it or reform it. Even in states where it's not like purple states, where it's not purely Democrat or Republican led, it has largely been a Democrat effort. We're seeing in Georgia, unfortunately, their legislative session ended already, very early in the year for that in comparison to other states. And so it already passed through the Georgia State House, and no one voted against it. And this was a bill largely pushed by Republicans. There was only one Democrat sponsoring it, and it was read twice in the Senate, and it unfortunately it wasn't read a third time and voted on, but it does seem in the future that this legislation could very well pass.
No, it just seems like, you know, it's crazy that you could pay someone a quarter an hour, but there are arguments for this. And, you know, can you help me walk through some of the arguments of leaving it the way it is? Because, you know, I asked a couple of people about this. I said, well, what do you think? And I got every excuse under the sun on why we should keep it. What are you hearing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is a lot of people don't know what Cisco. Like, if you ask like 100 people on the street, a lot of people's responses will be like, wait, I had no idea that was a thing. Because when you think of subminimum wage, you're like, oh, are you talking about people who are getting tip wages or something? This doesn't come to mind. I think that also when it comes to arguments, I also think another thing to keep in mind, when this legislation was passed, this was when, unfortunately, when people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who largely work in these positions today were locked up in asylums. This legislation was mainly made for disabled veterans who were getting back into the workforce. And so an argument against keeping the way it is that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities won't get hired anywhere else. There are many reasons, I think, where this isn't a good argument. Number one, and just looking at the history of what this was for, this was obviously not the purpose. Second of all, we see states that have started to get away from this, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities aren't being unemployed at higher rates. I also think one reason why this is looking positive to passing in Georgia doesn't actually have that many workers under what's called the 14C certificate. So every company that is applying for the ability to pay disabled workers less than minimum wage, they have to be approved by the federal government.
Okay.
And so Georgia only has 8. And so that's
it? Just 8 people?
No, sorry. Like 8 different places.
Oh, okay.
And that ranged from 4 people to 77 people in some states, because there's like 40,000 across the country. Some states have hundreds of people per warehouse. And also in a lot of these places, they're what it's referred to as a sheltered workshop, where disabled workers are effectively almost segregated from everyone else. So they're not surrounded by non-disabled workers too, which also a lot of disability rights advocates have taken problems with, just because disabled people shouldn't be separated from everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest response that I got from it, I asked a couple of my Republican friends, you know, what they thought, and their response was, well, you know, the federal government or state governments are making up the difference. This is an incentive to get employers to hire people, to get them, you know, some skills and get them into the workplace and, you know, mainstream them back into society. So they were opposed to, you know, doing away with it because their belief, and help me here if you think if they're wrong, their belief is that, you know, the federal government and state governments and all these other agencies, you know, Social Security, disability, and all these other things were subsidizing that wage. So it didn't really matter what they were making. They were still getting paid. Any thoughts on that? Have you heard that before?
I've heard that argument. I think something to keep in mind is that where are the examples that these sheltered workshops where people are being paid some minimum wage is getting people to work other jobs? In states where this is a practice. There are not many examples of this. And second of all, I think disabled poverty is a huge issue. We know people with disabilities, whether they have an intellectual disability or blind or something else, live below the poverty line as like at twice the rate as non-disabled people. So if that's going to change, people need to be paid a fair wage. And unfortunately, in states like Georgia, being paid, which their state's minimum wage is like $5 an hour, so most jobs that end up being the federal minimum wage, which is $7, that, of course, is still not a living wage.
No, absolutely, which is why I was going to ask you, because in your piece, you quote this Dom Kelly, the CEO of a nonprofit organization down there called New Disabled South. And he said, for the disabled people who can work, a living wage is a step to address disabled poverty, but making a few dollars or even cents an hour is not. Being paid a subminimum wage, Kelly says, hinders and prevents disabled people from having autonomy in their lives. And I agree with that. But aren't the minimum wage and the living wage, aren't those separate issues? Because there's no way to make an argument that today's minimum wage is anywhere close to a living wage. So I think we should argue the same things, which is, I think we should all be arguing that every working person should earn a living wage.
I absolutely agree with that. And I also, a rhetorical question is, why is it okay to pay someone less than minimum wage, which is already way too low, when they're part of a protected class?
No, I'm right there with you. You know, why should
totally
they
rhetorical.
Get cheated? But I go back to what was told to me earlier, which is this idea that that someone's subsidizing it, that they're making this incentive, that the employers will hire someone who may not have had an opportunity to get that job because of the subsidy that governments, state, local, federal, whatever, are giving them. Do you find that to be something that you're hearing? Because I'm not the expert on this, but I think that's a valid argument.
I've heard that argument from mostly non-disabled people who say either their family member or someone else can't work elsewhere. We know that there are companies in other states that have specifically worked to accommodate workers with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I mean, a huge one is Microsoft. Microsoft, I know one of the things they're hiring people with intellectual and developmental disabilities for is to work in some of their cafes. And so that doesn't mean that, and of course, whether you not have a disability, that's the case for everyone. You won't get hired for every job, but that's true with everyone, and not everyone can do every job.
Correct.
So we definitely know there are transitions in other states, and also having a job where it's, let's just say you're boxing something or something else, that might not even be the best job for you that you can succeed in. And these are the job. And of course, if someone's happy doing that job, doing that well, that's great. I think there's a lot to say about the concerns of automation taking away those jobs. So fair criticism as well.
No, there's a lot to this. And look, you know, at the end of the day, my true north, Julia, has always been every job, no matter what it is, no matter what skill level it is, every job should be respected. Every job has dignity, and every job should be able to put food on the table and a roof over your head. So for this, this seems like a step in the right direction. My fear is, as some have told me, you know, it's that, you know, the good intentions rule, that, you know, you want to do the right thing, but sadly could end up in somewhere worse. Are there examples of states who have done this and gone in this direction where there is data that says, no, this worked perfectly? These people got the jobs they needed. They got raises. They were able to move forward. Are there examples of that that we can look at?
Yeah, there's absolutely examples. I would say it's mostly looking at companies that have like shifted models. Even in some states, I believe it's a company called Melwood is a company that where they used to pay workers some minimum wage, and now they don't. And the company is still doing well. And so we're definitely seeing examples where things are changing, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are finding work elsewhere.
Excellent. No, because here's the thing. Like, if you could pay a CEO, you know, a gazillion dollars a year, or, you know, 400 times what the average working person is, I can't imagine what that would be for someone getting the subminimum wage. You know, what, a couple thousand times? So for me, it's just about basic dignity.
Basic dignity.
And fairness. Yeah. So finally, lastly, I want to get your thoughts on, isn't the rule of the land already making reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities? Haven't we had a law on the books that I lobbied for back in the 90s to get George H.W. Bush to pass? You know, something about Americans with disabilities. Don't we already have this?
Yeah, and that also brings back to another point in my article. The Americans with Disabilities Act, which is the legislation you're referring to, it was signed into law by a Republican president, and it also was supported by Republican members of Congress. So, like, let's just disability civil rights legislation about jobs for people who can and want to work doesn't have to be a Democrat issue. It
yeah,
can
but
be
a bipartisan I got to stop you issue. Here. Got to stop yeah. here. That was a different Republican Party. Very much different. Very different.
That is true.
In the time,
but I think Georgia can be an example of the current Republican Party.
Okay.
As we know.
No, I'm going like with you there. This is beautiful.
Just looking at Georgia.
No, I love the fact that there can be some bipartisanship mm-hmm. on something yeah. that respects work, that rewards work, especially when you're talking about someone who's being cheated. It's amazing mm-hmm. to me, the more you look at our laws, at how some groups are marginalized. It's the mm-hmm. voiceless. It's the powerless. Those are the folks who keep getting screwed over. And when there's a moment when they can get some justice, I'm all on board.
I absolutely agree as well.
So last question, what do we do? You know, how do we get this pushed through in our state? I'm not even mm-hmm. sure if Pennsylvania has a subminimum wage. I now got to double check this.
I'm pretty sure Pennsylvania still has some minimum wage for disabled workers. I'm pretty sure. And including states that have passed it, it's not necessarily all in blue states either. Like Massachusetts hasn't done anything. And I was raised in Massachusetts. I got that before the call. It was either, I believe it was New Hampshire, for example, which it's a purple state, and Maine as well, have passed it. One thing that you can do is get in touch with your state legislator to talk about why you think this is a problem, point them to other states that have passed it and their reasoning, and also point to examples of companies that have hired people who used to be paid subminimum wage, and as well really uplifts the voice of disabled workers who want change and they want autonomy. And well, you can't have any autonomy in your life if you're paid cents an hour, just in terms of being able to afford rent or
and that's whether
like
you're
that.
Disabled or not. Look, at the yeah. end of the day, if you don't have the economic freedom to take a day off from work, to put food on the table and a roof over your head, you don't have very much. But Julia Metro, I appreciate you taking some time. Great piece. Hope folks will take a look at it. In Georgia, a rare bipartisan push for disability rights, written by Julia Metro. We'll get links out on social media. Julia, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You know, again, I look at this and the fight for just basic dignity. This is a kind of a big thing. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that labor organizer Frank Norman disappeared from the Lakeland, Florida area and was never heard from again. It's believed he was kidnapped and murdered by members of the Ku Klux Klan. Norman was organizing citrus workers in the northern part of the state. The citrus groves, cigar factories, and textile mills in the area maintained a highly segregated workforce. The Klan terrorized workers and labor organizers that dared to disrupt this segregation by attempting to organize workers across racial lines. Klan members marched in parades through workers' neighborhoods and burnt crosses near union meetings. The next year, another union organizer, Joseph Shoemaker, was kidnapped by the Klan. Shoemaker had come to Florida from Vermont to organize cigar workers. 44 Klan members took Shoemaker and two other men 14 miles into the woods outside of Tampa. Shoemaker's leg was plunged into boiling hot tar. He was beaten and tortured and left for dead. When he was found, doctors tried to save his life by amputating his leg. But after 9 agonizing days, he died from his injuries. The investigation into the crime showed collaboration between the Klan and the local police. 5 policemen were convicted and sentenced to just 4 years in jail for their role in the terror attack. But the next year, their sentences were overturned and they were released. No one was ever held accountable for the murders of Norman or Shoemaker. These two men, and countless others forgotten by history, gave their lives trying to organize workers and stand up for racial justice. The Klan terrorized union organizers across the South, in states like Tennessee, Georgia, and South Carolina. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, look, you know, I think it's fantastic that Georgia is finally, you know, coming into the 21st century. I think it's fantastic that 16 other states across this country have already done this. I wish it were more. I wish we were fully in the 21st century. But the sad reality is, and this is where, again, Georgia's shocking me, that you've got Republicans going, hey, we should add some dignity to that work, instead of doing what they have been doing for, well, most of my entire life, which is destroying working conditions for working people. I say all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Look at the policies that they pursue. Now, you look at the fact that the Fair Labor Standards Act, the FLSA, was passed in 1938. And look, it is a central part of our labor law. Sad reality is it was 1938 that this was passed and compromised on. But it did some really incredible, monumental things where you stop and you think about it and you go, do you think today we could get such a life-changing piece of legislation passed? Because remember, back then, we were still living in the era of liberty of contract, where if you were desperate enough to work for poverty wages in deplorable conditions, that was your right. You had the liberty to work in desperation. You had the liberty to be cheated. You had the liberty to be used, abused, and discarded. Yeah. And because of the Fair Labor Standards Act, they established a minimum wage. Said, this is going to be the floor. Now, sadly, again, this is the part where you go, a lot of marginalized groups, a lot of voiceless groups, they got left out. They got compromised away. But for the mass of society, this was incredible. Setting a 25-cent minimum wage back in that era was huge. And minimum wage went up every couple, because it was popular, giving people a raise to be able to put food on the table and make it an actual living wage. And the reason I brought it up with Julie is I think people think that, you know, if we raise the minimum wage, that will be a livable wage. No, it won't. We raised it to $7.25 back in 2009. It wasn't a livable wage then. So I look at this now and you go, let's have the right conversation. Let's talk about livable wages for all working people. But the federal minimum wage was set in 1938. And again, we can fix the problems with this and we start moving towards. Also, the Fair Labor Standards Act established overtime pay. That fight for the 8-hour day, the 40-hour week work week, that 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will, inculcated in law, required employers to pay these workers time and a half after 40. Now you go, the unions went much further. It was, you know, in my experience, it's always been time and a half after 8, which is where it should be. And I'll tell you, was shocked when someone said, what? Overtime after 8 hours? Yeah, that's the way it should be. This way, one, respects your time. You're not always going to be working 10, 12 hours a day at the beginning of the week, and then, well, we don't have anything for at the end. And rewards work. Also, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which, again, under attack. Remember, most Republicans of the era, not thrilled with this. They liked children right where they were, working in the mines and in the factories. The FLSA included provisions to protect minors from being exploited in the workplace, restricted and limited the number of hours that they could work in the workplace, the kinds of jobs that they could do, which right now, again, as I say, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. They want your kids back in the workforce. They want mom and dad competing with junior in the workplace because it's good for profits, good for corporations. Also, it put into this idea of equal pay for equal work. It sought to end gender bias. And you go, but Rick, it's you know, this is how it is today. Yeah, we've got a lot of work to do. But they tried. They were trying to get to that place. You know, striving for a more perfect union. Also put into place enforcement mechanisms. A division of wage and hours so that when you get cheated, which, understand, truck drivers get cheated on minimum wage all the time. They have the right to pursue minimum wage claims. Remember, that tipped employee that works at the restaurant, a lot of times they get screwed out of minimum wage. There's a mechanism. Sadly, we don't use it near enough because it's underfunded. But there is a mechanism in place to protect workers from being screwed over. It requires, you know, employers to keep records so that you can make sure that they're in compliance with the law. That, I'll tell you, important stuff. And it prohibits retaliation. Now, I don't think, again, it goes far enough, as most of our laws don't, because it was always a compromise. You know, we've got to cater to the business-friendly crowd. Now, does it exempt certain workers? Yeah, unfortunately, it does. Now, it exempts, you know, the CEO and professionals and people who are exempt from minimum wage because they make high wages. But again, you go back to the 70s when the number in today's dollars would have been like, I think it was like 45, 46,000. It would have been for before you could get exempt. To where just a couple of years ago when Obama was trying to raise it, it was 26.6. So if you worked at a fast food restaurant and they gave you a cute little name tag that said assistant manager, you could work 100 hours a week, 52 weeks a year for 26.6. Just because, hey, you've got a cute title. Now, Obama tried to raise it up to 47. I think during the Trump years, they lowered that down to into the 30s. It should be back up into the 40s and 50s because we don't want workers to be exploited in this way. And I remember people going, well, you know, we're going to raise them, but you're going to hurt business. No, you're not going to hurt business by ensuring that workers get a fair shake and get, you know, access to overtime. Because maybe what you do is maybe don't work them that many hours. You don't have to pay the overtime. You don't. You could respect their time. And you look over the years since 1938, we've made various adjustments. We've done all kinds of things. Changing labor conditions as we needed things. We've done some, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. And this is where I come back to in this moment. We should be talking about major comprehensive labor law reform. The last time we had labor law reform in this country was the 1930s. 35, you get the National Labor Relations Act. 38, you get the Fair Labor Standards Act. You start talking about influencing the economy in a way that benefits working people. And understand, from that point forward, what we've had are Republicans time and time again siding with business interests, gutting those laws to ensure the pendulum swings towards corporate power. Because understand, the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, what it understood corporate America, the boss, has all the power. They decide when you work, where you work, how you work, what you get paid, all of that stuff. They decide all of it. Workers have zero power in the workplace. It is an authoritarian dictatorship at work. That's how it is. And what the NLRA sought to do was give workers some bit of say, some bit of voice, some bit of dignity. When do we get to redo this in a way for the 21st century? As AI comes online, as robotics come online, as who knows, maybe they're going to start mandating, you know, if you want to work here, got to get that chip in your head to make you smarter. Look, I'm already seeing places where they're putting chips in people's hands so that they can clock in, use the vending machine, access their whatever. Places where I've already taken retinal scans to let you get into places. We need a 21st century workers' bill of rights, a new updated Fair Labor Standards Act, a new updated National Labor Relations Board that's going to deal with today's issues. Because understand, our conservative friends, they want to take us back to the days of desperation and poverty. They want to take us back to the Lochner era. No questions about that. And child labor laws, and minimum wage laws, and maximum hour laws, and all of the safe working conditions, all the regulations, all that. And they tell us this. It's just, we got to believe them. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, or you can catch the video at freespeech.org. As always, I appreciate you being here. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here next time.
been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come.
You're listening to The Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.